Jill. Well, I'm looking out over a sea of people packed into the arena of the Royal Albert Hall. They've had to move forward two or three times to fit all the rest of the prommers in at the back. This is an extremely well-attended prom. And no surprise at all, Valery Gergiev and the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre performing Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Well, although we're in the Royal Albert Hall, which I have to say is an extraordinary concert hall, enormous and dark red and plush, we have to imagine tonight that we're in a very different sort of hall or theatre. This one is much, much smaller, although I would say it's even more plush and glittering, dripping with gold. The interior of the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg, which was built by Tsar Alexander II and has an orchestra which dates all the way back to the time of Peter the Great. Well, the current members of the Mariinsky Orchestra, some of them at least, are on stage here right now, and they've all filed on, and they're about to tune up. And they're going to present us tonight with what I'm amazed to say is the first ever complete performance of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake at the BBC Proms. It's pretty hard to imagine. Well, Swan Lake is probably the most important ballet ever written, but it wasn't an instant hit when it was first performed at the Bolshoi. They found it unperformable. And it's basically thanks to the Mariinsky Theatre that it's so well loved today and such a success. Because after Tchaikovsky had died, in 1895, the theatre's music director Ricardo Drigo put together the Mariinsky performing edition of Swan Lake, and it's that that we're hearing tonight, not Tchaikovsky's original, which I suppose, at least in the concert hall, we're more familiar with today. Well, this is, of course, music which stands alone without the ballet, but what I think is so radical about Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake as a ballet is that it's all about the narrative rather than just music to accompany pretty dancing. So it is really worth knowing the story. And if you've never seen Swan Lake, but you have recently seen the film Black Swan, then you'll have some idea of it already. Well, we're going to start with Act 1. Scene 1 takes place in a German castle, Prince Siegfried celebrating his coming of age. His mother announces that tomorrow at a grand ball, he's going to have to choose himself a wife. At the end of the night, a flock of swans is seen. Siegfried pursues them with his bow and arrow. Then in Scene 2, we see the swans swimming towards a ruined castle at night. Siegfried shoots at the main queen swan, and she turns into a princess, Odette, explains she's been transformed into a swan by an evil magician, Rothbart, and the only thing that can save her is the eternal pledge of love from a man who's never loved another. Needless to say, they fall in love. That is tonight's conductor, Valery Gergiev, making his way on stage to join the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre in Act 1 of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, the Mariinsky version.
Thank you.
That was Act One of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, in the same performing edition in which it's been heard since 1895 in the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg. The current artistic director of the Mariinsky Theatre, the world-renowned conductor Valery Gergiev, conducting members of the Mariinsky Orchestra live here at the Royal Albert Hall for the BBC Proms. The moment the applause started, Gergiev brought to their feet all of the soloists who definitely deserve a mention from the orchestra. The principal oboist, Sergei Buznetsov, who has Odette's wonderful theme right the way through. Also the leader tonight, violinist Kirill Terentyev, harpist Odarka Voshak, and the principal cellist, Oleg Sendetsky, all of whom had solos in that wonderful moment towards the end of Act One, where Odette and Prince Siegfried fall in love. Of course, it's not over. Stay tuned for part two of tonight's prom. Of course, here in the Albert Hall tonight, all we see is the orchestra. There are no dancers at all. We're just imagining swans and princes. But if there were dancers right now, they would be backstage already exhausted, rubbing their feet and preparing for the second half. Well, with that in mind, it's time now on Radio 3 for our 20-minute interval feature. The actress Samantha Bond has created for herself a virtual dressing room, and she's joined in it by two esteemed fellow performers to discuss the emotional and physical challenges of some of the great repertoire of the theatre world and the dance world.
For performers, the interval is a pit stop, a chance to nip into the service station and take on vital supplies. You hurry down narrow backstage stairways with the hum and the rustle of the audience fading behind you and find the sanctuary of your dressing room. Then it's all the very personal rituals that actors or dancers or singers need to relax and refocus and recharge. I longed to be a classical ballerina and trained at the Junior Rombert, and so I know enough about Swan Lake to be aware that that's exactly what the principals would be doing at this point if this were a full dance production rather than just the glorious music of a prom. But there's a difference with Swan Lake, particularly for the dancer taking the part of the Swan Princess and her alter ego, Odette Odile. She's still got one very particular Everest to climb. And not only that, it's an Everest that a huge chunk of the audience are waiting for. They're not malevolent about it. Well, not all of them. They just want to see if this particular dancer is up to it. She's very good, they've seen that already. But when the chips are down and the challenge is at its most telling, can she deliver? I'm talking about the famous sequence of 32 fouettés, full turns on point, finishing each spin facing out front and making the whole movement look both effortless and awesome. But then, that's why they're the prima ballerina. They train for Everest. They strain every sinew to have a tilt at this theatrical summit. And the same is true for the actor playing Hamlet, although he's got at least five soliloquy Everests to conquer. Or the tenor singing the part of Prince Calaf in Puccini's Turandot. He can have achieved a masterful interpretation of the role up to the point at which the famous Nessun Dorma music swells from the orchestra. Get that wrong, fluff the Pavarotti note at the end, and the evening lies in ruins. Or does it? Should it? Well, to help answer that, and to give some insights into what it's like facing these hair-raising theatrical challenges, I'm delighted to find myself sharing an imaginary dressing room with two of our great stage performers. Sir Derek Jacobi is familiar to millions for his television and film work, but he spent many a long hour on our most famous stages, and inevitably many a long hour in dressing rooms beforehand, contemplating what was to come. He's played just about all the great classical roles: Hamlet, Benedick, Prospero, Cyrano de Bergerac, Richard II, Richard III, Uncle Vanya, Macbeth, and most recently, a highly acclaimed and truly astonishing King Lear. Deborah Bull, CBE, is creative director of the Royal Opera House, and for 20 years was a member of the Royal Ballet, where she danced all the most challenging roles: Aurora in The Sleeping Beauty, Kittery in Don Quixote, many new pieces for choreographers like Ashley Page, David Bintley, Emma Diamond, and Twyla Tharp. And of course, Odette Odile in Swan Lake. So, Deborah, let's start with you, if I may. Those 32 fouettés, can you explain just how they fit into the action and how exactly you do a fouetté en tournant?
That's great. Describe this without any visuals. The fouettés are challenging in themselves, but to a professionally trained dancer, they're not that difficult. The difficulty is where they come in the piece, because they don't stand in isolation. They're the culmination of the third act, Black Swan, Pas de Deux. So you've done the duet with the man, a lot of the time standing on your left leg. And the left leg is crucial here. It's the left leg that kills. Then you do your solo, which I counted this once and I should have checked, but it has something like, you know, 30 releves on that left leg again, and ends with a sequence of turns around the stage, which push off from the left leg. So imagine hopping on your left leg. Effectively, you're doing that, but you're going up onto points. So your left leg at the end of your solo is at the lactic acid in your calf is absolutely poisonous. It's just cursing through the veins.
So we're talking major pain.
You're talking pain. Lactic acid. It's a bit like a really bad toothache. Is that pain? I guess you might call that pain.
That's pain.
I think most people know the feeling of lactic acid. It's stitch, basically, but in your calf. So you finish the solo and you milk that applause. My darling, you would think I had just delivered the Gettysburg Address when I just finished that solo. I'm milking the applause, walking off as slowly as possible, and then the orchestra starts up with that sort of bang on the drum. Dum bum 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 ba da da dee. And you're standing in the wings and you know that the partner has a jump around the stage, some turns in the middle, and then you're on. And you can hear it coming. And you've got to walk on, and you're still panting, and you still haven't got rid of the lactic acid, and you've been stretching that calf out, and you prepare centre stage, and you watch the conductor, and you go turn, turn, and then it starts. And essentially, you extend your leg to the front on a bent knee, then you whip your leg to the side and into the other knee and turn. So it's a whipping movement. Fouetter means to whip. And you plie and plie. Bend your knee, go up on point. Bend your knee, go up on point. 32 times on that left leg.
Yeah, so we need to be clear. The left leg is the supporting leg.
You don't come off the left leg. You never put the right leg on the floor.
That's the tricky bit.
So essentially, if you were to hop 32 times on one leg, that's about the experience that you're having. And so you're starting them from a position of exhaustion. So by the time you get to the end of them, that's what's killing about it. And in a studio, in rehearsal, on your own, it's fine. But at that moment on stage, with that that build-up, never mind the expectation of the audience, that's what's so hard.
Did you always manage the 32?
Well, yes, sometimes better than others. And sometimes it was 31 with a big smile at the end. and, of course, it's very hard to do them on the spot. You see, as your leg, the working leg, the right leg, whips around, it drags you forward. So you're travelling down the centre. So I have literally finished looking at the orchestra in the pit on the edge of the stage. But you just have to use willpower. You just have to say, I am not giving in. I am going to make this happen. I only get two performances a year of this role. I am not going to fail at this point. So it is a tremendous effort of willpower and concentration and really girding up, you know, getting that self-belief. I will not let this fail.
So, Derek, you've gone a little pale.
Yes. I mean, you said at the beginning of this marvellous description that it was easy.
Well, they are. You know, it's not a trick. It's a technical thing. It's a bit like a tennis player being able to serve an ace. It's part of your toolkit. You know, you do them by the time you're 14, 15 at a professional school.
I could only just do 16. I only ever managed 16.
I couldn't do one.
Not one for it?
No.
And what, Derek, what is the actor's equivalent? Because we don't have... Do we have the physical challenge?
No, I don't think we have that pain level.
I have to say, I do get a bit tired with this idea that ballet is necessarily painful and that we're bleeding all that. We're not. But like any marathon runner, as part of their job, will feel an extreme level of exertion. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about hospitalisation.
Yes, I understand
that. It's the job.
Yes. Well, I've recently been doing 8 King Lears a week. Mm. That is exertion plus. I mean, I've lost nearly 2 stone. It's a wonderful way to slim. I do recommend it. But it is a great physical exertion and great mental, psychological, and above all, vocal exertion. I've come to an age now when it was now or never to play Lear, because everything, thank goodness, is still working. And I have the physical stamina, the vocal stamina, and all the other things still going for me.
Yeah.
If I'd left it much longer, probably it would all start to diminish. But I suppose Hamlet is in the Shakespeare canon is... When you're young,
yes,
you go through the Hamlet hoop and everybody judges you on your Hamlet. Yeah. If you want to be part of the classic club, then how good is Hamlet? Then if you're allowed into the club and your Hamlet's all right, and then it is the big personality role, So anybody can play it virtually, male, female, big, short, fat, thin. Mm. Then when you get older, having been a member of the club for several years, they say, well, I think it's time to test whether we were right all those years ago to let him into the club. We've got to see his Lear now. So that's the big challenge. And that was always like an elemental on my shoulder when I started it.
And when you get to, for example, that blow winds and crack your cheeks, which was, for those of you who didn't see it, was absolutely one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. But could you describe how you approached that? And
well, it was a decision made during rehearsals. The scene immediately before it is a great diatribe from Lear to the two daughters. I mean, he is at the height of his rage. Gloucester comes on and says the king is in high rage. And his next scene is the storm scene. And I had kind of exhausted myself vocally in that scene. And during the rehearsals, I thought, well, a solution to this would be not to come on in the storm scene and scream and shout yet again. And helped by lighting and sound, I thought, what if instead of Lear having to beat the storm and speak above the storm, that he suddenly finds the quiet storm centre. And other words, we forget about the storm for a minute and we go into Lear's head. Mm-hmm. We go right inside his head on what he's thinking and feeling. And so there is a big, big storm. The sound and the lights and the smoke are going and suddenly stop. And very quietly, in his head, he's saying, blow wind and crack your cheeks, rage blow. And he does it all inside himself. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
It did work.
I have to admit that for that little passage, I was mic'd. I had a mic on me so that I could speak as quietly as that. And it would ricochet around the audience. Mm. But it did. Audiences who were expecting the biggie got the smallie.
Yeah.
And they were excited by that.
Yeah.
And it worked, thank goodness.
And when you were doing your Hamlets and you get to the to be or not to be,
yes.
Can you feel the audience?
It's an extraordinary moment. It's the one line they all know.
Yeah.
They might know the next one or two lines, perhaps, but that's the line. Whenever I said it, and I'm sure whenever any Hamlet says it, the silence in the audience is tangible. It is such a silence that it's noisy. It's like everybody does an intake of breath. And it's extraordinarily exciting for the actor playing Hamlet.
Well, this is the other side, of course, these theatrical Everests, if we're going to call them that. They are the challenge. They are the moment that the audience is waiting for. And then there's the thrill. And Deborah, when you've done your 32, and sometimes I've been in an audience where you can hear people going, one,
oh, yes,
two, and three. When you've finished, you know, the exhilaration must be huge.
It's a huge relief. And of course, it's not the end of the coda. You know, you finish that double spin and then the guy does another step down the ladder. You walk round to the back, or you limped round to the back, and you stand facing the back for as long as possible so that you can breathe through your mouth. Because when you're facing the audience, you have to breathe through your nose with your mouth closed. If you're facing the back, you can pant. Of course, if you're breathing through your mouth, you take more oxygen in. And then at the last minute, you turn round to him and again off you go down the diagonal, but luckily on the right leg this time. And then you go into the centre and you do 32 changements.
So 32
jumps. 32 jumps going backwards, and then you run forward, double pirouette, and finish. And then you are ecstatic. Delirious, actually. And, you know, the funny thing is, you always prepare three pair of shoes for Swan Lake, one for the second act, the white act, one for the black act, and one for the fourth act. You never bother changing them because you're so happy after the... Whatever happens in the fourth act is going to be absolutely fine. So you always, the last fourth act pair sit there.
Do you feel it can be the moment that the performance is judged on? Do you feel that if that bit goes wrong, that your evening has failed? You know, if you've only managed 29?
I think there is a danger of that. I think it's easy in advance to be phased by those challenges and to allow them to overwhelm you and to overwhelm your sense of the character, the entirety of the role, the plot development, all of those things. It can become only about the Fouettés or only about the Rose Adagio in Sleeping Beauty. And you have to consciously fight that. I think there is a danger that audiences will go away frustrated because, oh, she was great, but, you know, she didn't do the Fouettés. If they don't work, though, you just have to learn to put them behind you and move on, because there is an entire performance to give. So I think it's about discipline and concentration and just not letting yourself fall into that trap.
And Derek, the to be or not to be, do we judge Hamlet on that?
I think it's in a sense easier for the actor. He's got, with Hamlet, he's got five acts. No actor can get it all right. There is no moment, including To Be or Not to Be, or Bluebeards and Crack Your Cheeks, there is no moment in those great classical roles that you are judged on. You cannot really get To Be or Not to Be wrong. You've only got to say it.
Sense of Derek Jacobi.
And when I did it, I hedged my bets a bit because I said it not as a soliloquy. I got a bit of stick for that. But I can absolutely justify it textually that it's a speech to Ophelia. Please don't write in. but it works. It works wonderfully for both Hamlet and particularly for Ophelia, who has to do all the things that Hamlet talks about. She, in fact, commits suicide.
Yes.
She, in fact, goes mad. He doesn't do either of those things. He talks about it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, isn't it?
But, you know, the other thing that I was always very aware of as a dancer was not only the audience expectation, which is vast and huge,
yes,
and they all know and they're waiting and you feel them sit up, oh, how's she going to do? But it's the company around you.
Oh,
because
yeah,
these big, I call them the Beecher's Brook of ballet, you know, the 32 Fouettés, and they're all done with the company around you. And some of those members of the company will be thinking, don't know why she was cast, frankly. You know, and other people will be thinking, well, I saw her in rehearsal, she wasn't much carp, or, oh, gosh, she's a bit off today, or, oh, you know, I know where I'm... So you've got the your own audience,
yes,
of experts on the stage around you at the same time.
Yes.
It's not to say they're not, you know, that people are very good-natured and very supportive, but you're just very conscious that... Experts,
yes,
are watching you for much closer,
yes,
than the audience.
Yes.
It's a slightly,
yes,
different,
sure,
thing, isn't it, in the ballet world, Derek, from in theatre, is that, of course, all the young actors, when you're doing your Lear, are watching and learning and studying. I suppose,
yes,
the young dancers are.
I think they are. I think they're both aspirational and learning. But there might,
yeah,
be some older ones who wish they'd had the chance.
or thinking, I mean, well, it wasn't as good as my Lear.
Yes, yes. The sword carrier at the back.
Yes,
I did.
Yes, yes,
yes.
One of the famous ones that I've done was Juliet. And, of course, you get to that Romeo moment.
Yes.
And again, everyone's gone quiet and you're up on your balcony. And I now have a confession to make. I have a very weak R sound.
So have I.
Oh, I've
yes,
got a wuh sound.
Right.
I am a wuh.
Well, then, Deborah,
yeah,
you're going to,
yes,
appreciate the story to the full.
Romeo.
Exactly.
Yes.
So when I said it, I had to really, really concentrate that my tongue was in the right place so that I could go, Romeo, instead of going Womeo, which would have been a disaster. And I actually got a notice in the press talking about how thrilling it was that Samantha Bond, every time she spoke his name, there was this slight hiatus as though she could hardly breathe it.
Is that positioning your
wonderful
tongue?
Yes, I was literally putting my tongue in the right place.
But there is a great difficulty when the shoe that you're having to get into is so defined.
Yes.
Like that line. I mean, what do you do other than just give into it? Or you try to really rail against it and say, I'm going to do it my way,
yeah,
and people don't get what they came for. I mean, that's a real dilemma.
Yes, I heard a story of Dame Peggy Ashcroft, and she said a particular line in the particular... I can't remember the line or the play, but the critic Harold Hobson raved about the way she said this line, and continued to rave about the way she said this line in other reviews of other plays. He would refer back to Dame Peggy's way of saying this line, until finally Dame Peggy had to cut the line. She couldn't say it. She became so self-conscious, it was better not to be said, so she cut it and said it.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
So these big moments, the, what did you call them, the breaches?
The Beecher's Brook.
I think that's lovely. We love them, we hate them. They're part of the thrill of what we do. Deborah.
Well, they're a sort of rite of passage. I mean, as you said, yes, with Hamlet and Lear, you really can't call yourself a ballerina in the classical sense if you haven't done Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Khitri, yes, those roles. You can't really aspire to the roster of the great names. So you have to go through it. It's a bit like being baptised and then confirmed. You do them to be in the club, as you said. And you're always sensing the ghosts of the past. Always. They're right there in the wings watching, yes, and casting a shadow on you on the stage, and you're always aware of it. But you have to do them, and there is a huge sense of achievement.
Derek and I have a great mutual friend in Marguerite Porter. And Marguerite, who was a beautiful dancer, and I saw all her great roles, but the fouettés were never her strong point. And she'd get to about 28 or 29 and then finish beautifully and go and weep. But she has got a wonderful story about the Royal Ballet being on tour in America. And someone had decided that an outdoor performance would be a really clever thing to do, which with a ballet, you know, never mind, that was the decision they made. So they're in the middle of Swan Lake and the wind is coming up and it's a bit rainy and there are twigs on the stage and there are leaves on the stage. And Marguerite gets ready and she starts to ta 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 ta. And the lights went out. So she's standing in the stage, fouetteing. Is that a verb? Anyway, she's doing the fouettes. And for the first and only time, she finished 32 in total darkness. She did a fantastic finish and the lights came back on again. And no one ever saw it.
That story is celebrated in the
Really?
World.
How wonderful.
We know that story, that the time Marguerite did the fouettes.
Fouettes in the dark.
But I should say, she really was a beautiful swan queen. Mm. And I have in my diary, which I wrote assiduously when I was young, memories of watching her with Anthony Dowell and saying, you know, these performances were highlights of my watching career.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it never mattered.
Sir Derek Jacobi. Deborah Ball, thank you both very, very much indeed. And Deborah, the orchestra is tuning up, ready for the second half of tonight's performance, playing little snatches of the piece. Does your pulse still race?
Absolutely. I'm like Pavlov and his dogs when you ring a bell. You just play a few notes of that lead up to the fouettes and my palms are sweating.
Thank you both very much indeed.
Samantha Bond was talking to Deborah Bull and Sir Derek Jacobi. Not entirely spot on. The orchestra hasn't yet had a chance to tune up. They're making their way on stage now at the Royal Albert Hall as the Prommers do their usual chanting below me. Well, that was a rather compelling and slightly terrifying insight in what it takes to dance the role of Odette and Odile in our 20 minutes feature, which was called 32 Fouettes, and it was produced by Tom Alban. So, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second part of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, the 1895 Mariinsky Theatre Performing Edition. The orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre, who are almost all on stage now, and their artistic director and chief conductor, Valery Gergiev. So let's just do a little recap on what's happened so far in the story of Swan Lake. We've met young Prince Siegfried, who celebrated his coming-of-age party with all of his friends. Pretty riotous party. And his mother has not only given him a bow and arrow as a birthday present, she's also told him that now it's time for him to pick a bride. And there's going to be a ball tomorrow at which he has to choose the girl he's going to marry from one of the ones that she presents to him. He's then seen some swans flying over towards a lake and followed them with his bow and arrow and his best friend and shot at them. And the main swan has turned into a princess, Odette, and explained that she's been turned into a swan by an evil magician, Rothbart. She is, in fact, a princess herself, and the only thing that can save her is the eternal pledge of love from a man who has never loved anybody else. So, luckily, they fall in love. But now everything is going to go horribly wrong. In Act Two, it's the big ball for Siegfried to choose his wife, and six princesses dance for him, but he doesn't like any of them. Now then, Rothbart arrives, the evil magician, with his daughter, Odile, who bears a deliberately striking resemblance to Odette. She is the black swan to Odette's white. They dance, but Siegfried hesitates when it comes to pledging his love for her. Suddenly everything goes dark, and at the window, we see the white swan, Odette, absolutely devastated by the betrayal. Then it comes to Act Three. We're back at the lake. The swans are desperately looking for their queen. Odette finally appears and explains that she's been betrayed and she must die. Siegfried arrives and tries to pledge his love to her, but it's far too late. She jumps from a cliff. Siegfried follows her to his death, which, although it's a tragic ending, is also redemptive because Rothbart also falls down dead and his evil spell has been broken. And in many productions of Swan Lake, the two souls of Siegfried and Odette are seen floating up into heaven. Well, there's plenty of wonderful music to look forward to as well. Blazing chandeliers at the ball at the very beginning. And listen out for the different national dances, Spanish, Neapolitan, and also a Hungarian csárdás and a Polish mazurka. All that to look forward to in Act Two of Swan Lake.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Live on Radio 3, the first ever performance of the complete Tchaikovsky Swan Lake score at the BBC Proms. And it's really great Russian ballet straight from the horse's mouth. The orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre of St. Petersburg, conducted by their artistic director, the great world-renowned conductor Valery Gergiev. What we just heard was the original 1895 performing score from the Mariinsky Theatre with which they made the ballet famous. It had been a flop when Tchaikovsky first put it on. 1895, just a little over a year after Tchaikovsky had died. And ever since then, it's been really, probably I'd say, the most important ballet in the repertoire. Of course, all we've seen this evening here at the Albert Hall is the orchestra, no ballet dancers in sight. But for anyone who was missing the sight of ballet dancers, all they had to do was to look at Valery Gergiev's hands. They're absolutely extraordinary. He has this very distinctive trademark style of conducting. His hands dance about and flutter all over the place. He's bringing the whole orchestra to their feet. We just heard a little cheer for their leader tonight, violinist Kirill Terentyev. And must also mentioned the lead oboist, Sergei Buznetsov, who played the great Swan theme throughout tonight's performance, and also trumpeter Vasily Khan, who had a wonderful solo in the Neapolitan Tarantella. First time a complete Tchaikovsky ballet score was ever performed at the Proms was only 3 years ago. It was Sleeping Beauty, and it was tonight's conductor, Valery Gergiev, conducting his other orchestra, the London Symphony Orchestra, in that prom. And in fact, in 8 days' time, Gergiev and the London Symphony Orchestra are going to be here at the Albert Hall for their prom together, including music by Prokofiev and also Henri Dutilleux, the French composer. And if you enjoyed hearing what you've just heard, then do tune in to more Tchaikovsky on Wednesday this week. The Philharmonia Orchestra and Esa-Pekka Salonen are going to be playing Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini. You can hear the stomping. They don't want to let him go in the arena of the Royal Albert Hall. And I can understand why. Valery Gergiev is not an easy man to pin down. He notoriously flies in at the very last minute for rehearsals, and you never know quite what's going to happen backstage. But he's a real favourite here at the Albert Hall, particularly in London since he joined the London Symphony Orchestra. And at least 20 of the 80 performers on stage at the moment of the Mariinsky Orchestra have been in London for quite some time now. They've been doing a season at Covent Garden. So they probably feel very at home here already. Well, that's all from the Royal Albert Hall tonight. Tomorrow night, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra are going to be playing a fantastic big programme of music associated with the conductor, Serge Koussevitzky. Don't forget, in about 25 minutes' time on Radio 3, you can hear Valery Gergiev in tonight's Lebrecht interview. But for now, from me, Sarah Moore-Peach, it's time to hand you over to Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. Well, as Sarah said, we'll be hearing from Valery Gergiev in the Lebrecht interview at 10:15. He'll be describing his childhood in Ossetia, his controversial relationship with Vladimir Putin, and what drives him to live life at such a frenetic pace. Well, till then, here's more Russian music, this time for oboe and piano by Johann Heinrich Luft, who lived from 1813 to 1877. He was German by birth, but moved to St. Petersburg, where he was the principal oboe in the Imperial Theatre Orchestra for 20 years. This is his Fantasy on Russian Folk Themes, Opus 12, played by Yvonne Paisov and Natalia Shcherbakova.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ivan Paisov and Natalia Shechabakova played the fantasy on Russian folk themes, Opus 12, by Johann Heinrich Luft. Next, we've piano music by Mili Balakirev. This is the polka in F-sharp minor, and it's played by Margaret Fingerhut. Balakirev's polka in F-sharp minor, and it was played by Margaret Fingerhut. Since 1998, the BBC Inspire Young Composers scheme has been bringing together young composers to learn new skills and enjoy making music. This year, Inspire worked with hundreds of young composers through our composer labs and the Young Composers Competition. The winners' pieces were broadcast on Radio 3 on Friday, but we've yet to hear the works which were awarded highly commended in the competition. We're going to hear one of those pieces now by Daniel Evans, who attends Wells Cathedral School, where he studies piano and composition. His piece is called Anonymous D, and it's played now by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin.
Thank you.
was Anonymous D, a piece by the young composer Daniel Evans, which he entered for the BBC Inspire Young Composers Scheme and was awarded highly commended in the competition. The Aurora Orchestra was conducted by Nicholas Collin. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 16 minutes past 10. Time now for the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Valery Gergiev is by any measure a historic figure. As head of the Kirov-Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg since 1988, his is the only Russian arts institution to enhance its world standing since the fall of communism. Gergiev is also principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra and the World Orchestra for Peace. He runs festivals in Russia, Holland, Israel and around the Baltic, and he recently revamped the International Tchaikovsky Competition as a model of 21st century transparency. Too much, surely, for one man to cram into one life. There have been complaints that Gergiev skimps on rehearsal and detail. We shall see what he has to say about that. He's also accused of being too intimate with Russian power. Born in Moscow in 1953 of parents from Caucasia, Gergiev grew up in Vladikavkaz and considers himself Ossetian. He studied with the ruminative Ilya Muzin, and in his mid-30s, just before the end of communism, he succeeded Yuri Temirkanov as director of the Kirov. Since then, he's been tapped up by every major opera house, yet has remained true to the Kirov. He's married to Natalia, a fellow Ossetian, and they have three children. We meet at Mikkeli, in the middle of Finland, during a festival founded for Gergiev by the late critic Seppo Heikkinheimo, a close friend who brought us together 20 years ago. Valery Gergiev, why, with your impossibly crowded schedule, are you conducting a festival in the middle of Finland?
I like it here, and Finland, not being the biggest country in the world, is one of the best countries, if one can say best country. In principle, it's very difficult to put number one, number five, number 20.
Best for music.
Good for music, good for quality of life, smart, good economy, not very big population, yet very high quality of whatever they start doing, they somehow succeed, I think. Nature is kept in good shape, the healthy trees, forests, clean lakes, amazing. So I think
we're in the middle of a forest, in the middle of nowhere, and the festival is in a town of 20,000 people. You can get more than 20,000 people in an arena concert.
Yes, that's true, but you come here with your orchestra, you know for sure that musicians will enjoy it. If you give them free morning and then at 4 o'clock you rehearse before the concert, repertoire which normally musicians know rather well, and then at 7 or sometimes at 8 o'clock you have a concert, and then again you can spend time with your colleagues, musicians or your friends or some of the public, and then you can see your family even before you go to bed, and you take your children and they swim in the lake. So there are many, many pluses. It's smaller than Tanglewood, but I wouldn't say it's less nice. I wouldn't say so.
And it's less pressure than Tanglewood?
Maybe less pressure, but we don't think about pressure here. It's a country where people know what they want to do. So if public comes, they know the reason. They know the reason.
You had what sounds like an idyllic childhood, growing up in the mountains of Ossetia, surrounded by a large family, relatively free for a child in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, Soviet Union was a big country, and in many, many, many ways it was a good country. For example, education, not only it was free, it was strong. Music school, music education was fantastic.
In Vladikavkaz?
Even in Vladikavkaz. Would you believe it that in a city which population was at best 200,000 people, there's a culture which people wanted to keep. There are wonderful musical, theatrical, of course literature, of course poetry, of course painters, designers, sculptures. So it was a small universe, but there was an interesting world there. And my first teachers were amazing. And the Philharmonic concerts, which I now recall, that was like 40 years ago or 45 years ago when I was a really child. They were not only very interesting as a programs and relatively good quality. Look, it was not Vienna Philharmonic, the local orchestra, but they played in the classical repertoire up to Brahms Symphony or Preludes of Liszt or Symphony Fantastique of Berlioz and of course Tchaikovsky symphonies. There were many, many performances which one could attend, and amazingly, people like Sviatoslav Richter or conductor Nathan Racklin, or even young Yuri Temirkanov, I remember young Yuri Temirkanov conducted there, Rostropovich. Amazingly, you could see these names, legendary musicians or young future world stars, but they were coming. So it was not what you call totally provincial, not at all. And my teacher was himself a student of Kurt Zanderling, and later he moved to the class of Ilya Musin, who became my
teacher. So he recommended you to
Yes,
to
he told me, if you want to be a conductor, you have to go to Musin. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who Ilya Musin was very well, but he told me he's the best teacher in the world, and he believed I have to go, and even at a price to stop preparing myself for professional piano career, because I was playing piano then rather well, and I played with orchestra.
I've heard you. You still play rather well.
Well, so I think it is terribly important that my childhood was, I agree with you, very free, very happy, and until the moment when my father suddenly passed away. Totally sudden.
What happened?
Well, he had a stroke, and no one was prepared for that. He was 49 years old, and I don't think he was very lucky with the doctors around him. And he went, for the first time in his life, I think, he went to a resort in the city of Yessentuki, which is in the Caucasus, some 230 kilometers maybe from Vladikavkaz. And he was given a certain choices and maybe what you call mud bath.
Mud baths.
Yeah, mud baths. And I think this provoked a sudden stroke. But
So he had the stroke in the sanatorium?
Yes, in the sanatorium.
And died there?
Yes, they couldn't save him. And I don't think they had right people there around him, unfortunately.
And was he still in the army?
No. He resigned when he was 40 years old. He was destined to have, I think, significant what you call career in the military. But he was disillusioned. And basically, I think they made decision together with my mother, who was at least, 8 years younger maybe than him. And they decided to take all of us simply to Ossetia, and that we will grow in a natural native environment and understand the language, the culture. Of course, I'm grateful to both of them, because I think it was the best way for me to grow, to learn, especially about the world around me. But then it appears also to be the truth that my teachers in Vladikavkaz were amazing. Not only I could learn how to love music and why one should love classical music, but also they gave what you call, you give it all. And this is what my both teachers did. My first piano teacher, Zarya Malolayeva, and my first conducting teacher, Anatoly Briskin. He was 200%, 300% in everything, musically, 300%. And if he spent with me 2 hours, then these 2 hours I would learn immeasurably how to play piano, how to understand string instruments, how to understand the tempo, how to keep the tempo, how to bring energy, how to understand dramatic or lyrical.
How to shut out the world.
Basically, he was completely uninterested in anything else. When I was playing soccer with my friends, he would pass this small little stadium. And once he saw me running and after the ball and playing, and it was a huge match for us, because one street played against other street. If we were five and they were five, or we were six and they were six, to lose one player is just to lose everything. And he would shout, "Valery!" I look, "Oh, God, it's my teacher." He says, "What are you doing there? Do you want to become a football player?" First of all, the game stops. We were 17, 16 years old, and everyone around me was furious, because just in the most decisive moment, the game stops. And he says, "Are you going to become a footballer, or you want to be a conductor? Go to the class." And I obey, not because I had a fear, because basically I had a huge respect for him, and that I killed the game. That was the outcome. So I would go to the class, and he would tell me, "You better take this score and learn at least 5 pages. And he would give me a score of a suite, number 2 of Romeo and Juliet Prokofiev. And then he would give me a score of G minor symphony of Mozart. He would tell me, "Oh, by the way, you should learn the viola part in the first movement by memory." And if my memory says, this shout is, "Stop," because he was in the kitchen maybe having his tea. So, "Stop, wrong," collapse. He says, "You know, if you want to be a conductor, you have to know these things, because it's still an easy part. Many, many people can learn viola line, but very few people can make it to a real conductor. So basically, he was absolutely dead right. And I'm extremely grateful. So my childhood and my youth was full of joy and full of discoveries. But then suddenly my father passed away, and then life changed totally.
Many people who lose a parent early have the idea throughout their lives that there isn't time, that they have to fulfill something, and they have to fulfill it very fast, just in case they may die early, like their father. Was that the case with you?
Well, not really. At least I didn't think this way 20 years ago, when I was already what you call full swing, you know, going with the Mariinsky troops, and I didn't really rush because I thought I'll have never enough time. Now it's maybe slightly different. I have a certain feeling of what I am doing and what I have to do. There is a pressure for me maybe to do certain things that I can say, even in a few years, maybe in 5 years, that I really wanted this and this and this to happen, and basically I see it happening, so it gives me a certain good feeling of satisfaction and so on. But we are building now a new opera house. There is a wonderful concert hall. I can even sometimes say I built, because I was raising money.
Valery, this is almost an unnatural ambition. Most conductors would be very happy to have the achievement of sustaining one great opera house, world level, producing generation after generation of great singers, putting them out on the world stage. Yes, perhaps building a new concert hall, helping with the conservatory, gaining an international reputation. But no, you build a new opera house, and you take on an extra competition, and you take on another festival, and you do this. And what's the driving force here?
I can tell you easily. The answer is my conductor colleagues didn't have a difficult situation which was so challenging for them. Most of them did not.
The collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yes. First of all, disintegration and collapse of a big country. And in many ways, the risk of collapse for a big culture. There was a clear risk of losing most of great artists, not only for the country, which is already a problem, but even for a given institution, Mariinsky. There was a risk that the best musicians, the best singers, the best dancers, the best directors, so will be moving out, and what will be left will be relatively insignificant. You know, certain professionals, but not what it has to be. You know, in the Mariinsky tradition, requires a fantastic artist to be there and doing, for the history of this institution, some very interesting work artistically. Also, it was impossible with the budgets. They were so low, and they were even not fulfilled. So I learned it all from 88 till 96, let's say. It was a learning period, and certain difficulties made me feel very confident, very brave, and even sometimes what you call fearless, because in a difficult country, in a difficult circumstances, you had to overcome certain challenges. And by 96, I think the most difficult part was behind me. I felt that I have to lead this institution no matter what. I will have to simply tell musicians, or even tell administration, we're going to do this and that. We're going to visit this and this country or the city or the town. We create this and this festival. And Mikkeli was like a nice dessert, you know. Really, after what you do in a White Nights festival, immediately after you go and relax in a way in Finland. That was a good choice. But then in Israel, I felt Red Sea Festival was also interesting opportunity. Again, the country where it's known that not much money will be thrown behind musical event, but there is a love for music. There is a other city next door, which is Aqaba in Jordan, where we also performed, I remember. And the idea was also to bring more peaceful atmosphere, you know, and invite both Jordanians and Israelis also to share the same room, the same venue for concerts. And I am from outside, so I'm not a Jew myself, so I felt very easy about this, being slightly a missionary, and a slightly not a peacemaker, because nothing political interests me. But I felt that people will appreciate this effort, you know.
Even the way you describe it, Valery, It's an exaggerated sense of responsibility. If there is a problem, you have to be the one to step up.
Yeah, it's due to...
And I just wonder if that's not also a fact of you becoming the head of the family at 14, that you took that responsibility and that you continue to take it in other fields.
In some ways, yes, but my father was a strong man. I think he was very friendly to his friends and, of course, our relatives. They were with us, but basically I was a head of family in some ways. But my mother, who is now with me, she's 86 now. Then she was suddenly left young with three children. And she was, now I understand how strong she was. So she was not broken by this incredible, tragic change in our lives. But she was very strong. So she made sure that I will become a musician. First of all, it's not only my teachers, but in the first place, it's my mother. Because she knew there is something in this classical music for her children, especially for me, because she would somehow work harder and ask me yet another question. Did you practice? What did your teacher say? Are they happy with you? Go and play a little bit more before it's too late. Our neighbors will be not happy. But so now I understand it, because now I have my own children. So she was finally the main motor, if I may say, before I started to realize that I love classical music, which coincided with the death of my father. Somehow it came, the age you are 13, 14, you start to understand, or you simply play Beethoven sonata and you just continue to play it. It just gives you some incredible feeling, and you understand that it's maybe better than playing soccer with your friends on the street. This sense of responsibility, which I developed early on, is with me now, because there were circumstances where I had to defend, for example, Mariinsky. Simply what you call defend. Defend is you go whatever it takes, you just defend. And in the same way I was acting when we had the fire, our one of important buildings Mariinsky lost in the fire. Suddenly there was a wire, maybe, you know, it happens. So instead of being totally devastated and lost, I immediately felt bad news sometimes brings
opportunity.
Some kind of opportunity. And people will say, oh God, we lost this production and these sets, and we cannot play maybe 15 productions, which we had to restore, which also is money. And one of them was fantastic production, The Gambler, for example, which I love to conduct. We made another production with the same director, but that was a bad news. But in the first hours, certainly in the first or second day after this, I was already on the plane from Brussels to Moscow. And I went to two of my friends, Minister of Finance of Russia, Alexei Kudrin, who became finance minister much later. First, we became friends. And then other minister, Mr. Greff, German Greff, who himself is a German, but he was a minister of economy. Again, we became friends in 1994. He became a minister in 2000 or 2001. No one knew they would be in the government in Moscow, but they loved Mariinsky, and we instantly became friends. So it was easy for me to call them, and they knew from the news that there was a huge fire. But I was telling them, I think we have to make a fundraiser maybe in Moscow, because Moscow is the capital. We are federal theater. But I'm thinking maybe we should do something, not just restore these workshops. I'm thinking... And they both say, well, look, you have to know we all will do whatever it takes. Mariinsky is our most beloved institution. A few months later, I told them, I talked to Toyota-san. He's the greatest acoustician of our time. I brought him to St. Petersburg. We looked at the site. We basically believe we can make a great concert hall there. Now I have to start raising money. He is working already on the design for the hall. And then I'll bring architect who will also, of course, look at how to make it a building which is not only restored, but also we need a new facade, we need new foyer and all these things, which was done. And my friends were saying, well, we start campaign immediately. From the day we started this campaign to the opening, we had 15 months. 15 months. And not even me, they invited Mr. Putin to come because they told him, there is a new concert hall in St. Petersburg. You say, new concert hall? Which one? No, it's totally new because there was a fire. Oh, I remember. So when we told him, please come, it was for the opening, not even to help us raise money. Because, you know, in my country, you can raise money, maybe easier than Great Britain. But if you ask Prime Minister Putin or now President Medvedev, of course it will be easier. But I find it slightly different. The feeling you have a campaign to raise money and you have a powerful help from the Kremlin or from Prime Minister, it's not a campaign to raise money. It's basically taken as a, oh, well, there's a strong recommendation and the people basically have a problem to say no. But then they also have something to ask. And I didn't want to be part of this, you know. Okay, we are asked to do this, then we will ask at some point, there is another oil field or whatever. And it's much easier for me to feel that we did it ourselves with just few friends.
So your method of fundraising is you bring the diamond and the government then creates the ring.
Correct. It's well said, yes. Look, Russian tsars, they knew what they were doing. Catherine the Great, even Peter the Great, they knew how to invest in culture. People don't talk about it because they think Peter was winning the wars. But Peter knew how to invest in bringing right people and building the city, not only the powerful speed he had. Mm-hmm. Petersburg was built in like basically 10, 15, 20 years. There was a huge capital there. Mm. And then...
with all the best artworks in Europe.
Huge. And then Catherine, of course... she knew how to make friends with the best French or Italian philosophers or writers or composers.
And you see yourself as part of that tradition?
In a way. I didn't think of Peter the Great when we built Concert Hall. Really not. But
now you do.
But I think if everyone contributes to the city where he lives, and if everyone thinks, well, I have these 20 years at the helm, I have already 22 years, 23 years soon, as an artistic director of Mariinsky, and from 96, 15 years as a general director as well, because it was President Yeltsin who appointed me with his own degree.
His own stamp.
Yeah, because it was clear that everything was collapsing. So someone told him, maybe wisely, maybe not, I'm still considering both options, but someone told him that one leader should be responsible, because they felt then they lost Bolshoi totally. I was asked quite strongly. There was an offer, like in the film, you can't say no.
The Bolshoi.
Yes, and I didn't refuse because I knew it would be to betray the Mariinsky was not possible for me because it was only halfway what I thought I have to do. And I was under huge pressure from government, from Kremlin people. I told them, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. Well, you take it like an order because it's a President Yeltsin. I say, I just can't do it.
The president orders you to take
what,
the Bolshoi.
He didn't order. He told his deputies that this man, someone told his wife, I believe, that that's a solution for Moscow. And the wife maybe told the husband told the head of administration and Kremlin or the government, including even Prime Minister, that we should make this move. And they told me, we can't go back to President and tell him you don't do it. And I told them, look, I don't know how you solve your problem. I'm telling you, I just can't do it. I never went to the West like many of my compatriots did, just to live in the West. For me, it's not an option. But I can't leave Mariinsky. I can help Bolshoi. That's another story, of course. And I told them, make a program, which is called Russian Opera.
Yeah.
Don't move one man, kill the Kirov, and
maybe save the Bolshoi.
Save Bolshoi. Yeah. Just make a program, which will be what you call a must for both Mariinsky and Bolshoi, which means help young singers, help young dancers, bring great directors, make a very smart plan and finance in many ways this plan. And I convinced then Prime Minister, Mr. Chernomyrdin, mm-hmm. very interesting man, by the way, he came from gas industry. Mm-hmm. He was in the beginning not in a position even to ask me what should be done. We went together with Irina Arkhipova, legendary mezzo-soprano of Bolshoi. And she asked him to help her vocal competition. So she asked maybe $5,000, maybe $10,000. And he happily said, of course, don't worry. Of course we will help. He stood up and started to shake our hands. I didn't even say a word. And I also stood up because everyone stood up. And I told him, well, I still didn't tell you what I think. Oh, I thought you were together. I said, yeah, because I am from Mariinsky and she's from Bolshoi. We are together for two houses. And I told him, his name was Viktor Stepanovich. I said, Viktor, if you don't give today, basically, $10 million each institution, we will lose them. Russia will lose them. It was grave silence, of course. I said, what? I said, I will give Irina Konstantinovna $10,000 myself. because I was earning quite a lot of money in the West. But please remember, if you don't give, basically now, $10 million each, they will be dead. 2 years maximum. Especially Bolshoi is dying. What? He says. But why? And he looked at his advisor. He said, what, why you didn't tell me? It's so bad. The advisor looked at me, says, Mr. Gergiev, we now go out, we will talk, you explain to me everything and we'll fix it. You can't take the Prime Minister's time now. I told, no, I'm sorry. I already took his time because he is seated again. I am telling you the truth. And look, that is one way. You fire me, I will end up immediately in America or in England or in Germany as a big, big boss of one of the biggest institutions on earth. That's not the best choice. You keep me here, and believe me, it's bad. When did you come last time to Mariinsky? I asked Chernomyrdin. He looked at me, says, you know, honestly, I never was there. What do you want from me? I'm from gas industry. You know, I was all my life building this gas, the power that Russia has. Oh, and then it was this emotional click. I told him, why don't you come? We'll wait for you. He says, well, unfortunately, this, and he basically made it clear that he wanted to say these idiots, his team, they never tell me there is a problem. They always draw some nice pictures. And we know we have a problem in Chechnya, we have a problem with economy, with pensions, with old people, with medical, but God, I didn't know we have a problem even with the two theaters. So yes, you have a very big problem. Maybe 1 month, maybe 2 months later, it was announced both theaters get $10 million each. So this is typical of Russia. At some point it becomes decisive, they act. Unfortunately, first they allow it to go down, then last second they save it. That's the story of Russia from Ivan the Terrible and then Peter the Great and then throughout all these wonderful times or horrible times, it's always like this.
Let me ask you about Vladimir Putin. Yeah. When you were a very young conductor, the Mariinsky, he was a very young deputy mayor in St. Petersburg, in Leningrad, and you became friendly.
I met him in 1992 on the developments of so-called New Holland. It's an island, the heart of St. Petersburg, about 300 meters from Mariinsky, mm-hmm. next door. Mm-hmm. Peter the Great built it for Russian fleet because it was exactly between Mariinsky Theater and Neva River. So the place is phenomenal. Architecture, phenomenal. It just needs to be restored. Mayor Sobchak, who was the boss of Mr. Putin in 1992, suddenly called me and he says, Valery, where are you now? I said, Mariinsky. Oh, please come immediately. Come immediately. Can you? I said, well, I have a rehearsal. It's very important. Okay. 10 minutes later, I was there, and there were five or six people I didn't know. And maybe three of them were French investors. It appears that Sobchak had one of his big meetings on how to save the city, how to transform the city. And the French investors he invited, most probably, were talking about New Holland. Once they learned Mariinsky is next door, they say, oh, that's fantastic. You can have white nights in the festivals here. We can open there. And then, of course, we put a lot of shops and restaurants and hotels. It would be one of the best places in the world. Sobchak was so thrilled to hear it. And after a short introduction, he says, and this is Mr. Vladimir Putin. He's my first deputy, and he will deal with this problem. I said, oh, nice to meet you, nice to meet you. Sobchak went on to continue something else. We go with Mr. Putin, and he says, well, it's very important for the city, of course, and I hope it will work. Let's be in contact. These people will go back to Paris. Obviously, it's a question of financial, and we have to get these and these and these permissions and so on, because it's the center of the city. You can't just come in and start building. And obviously, investment 20 years ago was on a level of $100,000, and now it will be on the level of $100 million. That's the change Russia went through. So if you talk about Mr. Putin, his historical role was to come in a moment when about one-third of population in Russia and maybe two-thirds outside Russia thought this country would disintegrate.
You credit him with saving the country?
I would say then he was one of the few who could save this speedy disintegration or potential disintegration of Russia.
You admire him?
I respect him for what he did and in many, many areas, including cultural.
You like him as a person?
I think he's very focused. I like his very serious focus on how to do it. For example, 300 years of St. Petersburg, I was to conduct the most important cultural event of celebration. It was in the Mariinsky. So I was responsible, and I would ask him very simple question. For example, 1 year before these celebrations were to be held, I asked him, but how 40 or 50 heads of states will come to Mariinsky? Helicopter? Or boat? Or bus? Or two or three buses? Or 50 corteges, which will take maybe 10 hours simply to with the security and so on. So he actually looked at me and says, I can't believe it. We are talking for 1 year. No one even asks this question. But I was simply, look, artist is allowed to say strange thing because I'm not deputy prime minister. I'm not minister of transport. I am artist, but artist who will host in a way this. And he knew very well. So sometimes he was clearly impressed that Mariinsky is doing good things. He was saying, I don't understand why I go to China or go to Japan, I go to US or I go to Africa, and no one tells me about Bosho. Everyone speaks about Mariinsky and Valery Gergiev. That's what the difference, he says. I don't understand the reason. Maybe it's just one person makes a reason. I said, no, it's just we are more active. That was always my answer, which, by the way, we are. We performed last season 740 times. Bolshoi maybe 225 times.
What do you say when people say that you're too close to the government, you're too close to the political center?
It's a nonsense, total nonsense. I see Mr. Putin 3 times a year or 2 times a year. Total nonsense. I already commented on this. But
alone or with other people present?
Sometimes alone once or twice. I saw him alone maybe 6 times in my life story altogether. And maybe with other people another 6, 5 times, and maybe I was with him for the opening of Tchaikovsky competition. Look, the word smart is good. You know why? Smart president or prime minister understands that for France or for Great Britain or for US or for Russia, for me it doesn't look different. Louvre or Hermitage or Mariinsky or Royal Opera House, the Met, should I continue? The smart understands it is important. Then comes too busy, for example. I don't know if French president is too busy or not, but does he come to concerts? Rarely, maybe not. The last 4 or 5 prime ministers of Great Britain, are they really closely watching the music scene in London? For example, 5 London operas.
I think the only time Tony Blair went to the opera was when Vladimir Putin took him.
And it was in the Mariinsky.
Yes.
Okay, so I was part of this little thing, okay? So look, why? Because Putin came, what you call it, out of nowhere, and being smart, he looked around him. He found devastating shape of the country. Everything collapsing. Nothing working. The only leftovers are little leftovers, national prestige, of which Mariinsky and Hermitage were the 2 big players. Whatever you say, not even 3 big players, not even Russian Circus, or not even Bolshoi. He saw it immediately. But Hermitage and Mariinsky were still internationally respected, active, rich, because Mr. Piotrowski in Hermitage is there all his life. Now it appears I'm all my life in Mariinsky. So I think he was very smart, very pragmatic, and very conscious of the fact that culture is what Russia didn't lose yet. I think he will never change his mind about cultural priorities. That's my explanation. And I wish in Great Britain, no matter what, Prime Minister or Lord Mayor of London or the City of London Corporation and so on would say that we have to do even more for our flagship orchestra like London Symphony, or even more for educational process around these wonderful orchestras and opera houses. Why not English National Opera or Royal Opera House or London Symphony? I just talk about those institutions I know pretty well. Receive even more help with the condition that Great Britain remains a huge leader worldwide for bringing the youth from all over the world to the heart of classical music and giving them the best possible training and the most incredible programming and so. But it needs support. Russian orchestras will not even think this way. But Mariinsky is doing it already many, many years because, in a way, I see what London Symphony wants to do. I wish London Symphony had more funds just to do a bigger, on a bigger scale, globally. They can do it because the quality is so good. But why orchestras should die like Philadelphia? At least what we hear from Philadelphia is horrifying bankruptcy. Then they hope someone will come with $20 million, and then 3 years later will be another wave of fear and bankruptcy, and then another old lady will come with $30 million. That's not the future you built. You don't want if to dominate your hopes. You know, if you have to know why you should be supported. I told my friends in Philadelphia, well, there is a fear in America that the funding is thinning. For the orchestra, yeah, of course, not so good, it's not as good as it was. Say, why don't you look at education, and why don't you occupy the most important field you never touch? This is theater. You are a great orchestra. Why don't you play opera and ballet? Create your own festival. Can you imagine if in Philadelphia there will be 1 month of opera activities, and everyone will say, oh, Philadelphia Orchestra in the pit. Wow. It's like Glyndebourne. Why not? But that was not a scenario for them, because these are unionized orchestras, and they don't give up. Even if they die, they say, we are proud unions, we will not give up. And then they die. So it's one has to be smart. Back to Putin.
Where does the energy come from, Valery? I mean, the first time you and I sat down together, you called me at midnight and said, I'm free. I came round to your office. We finished at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there were still two people waiting in the anteroom for the next meeting.
Yeah,
it's, and it's, you still work at that place.
Yeah, I still make the same mistakes. That's what you want to say. Mravinsky had one great quality, and so did Karajan, very different conductors. Mravinsky was impossible to be approached. Impossible. I respect this very much, because when you are a conductor of such a caliber, it is good for classical music that whatever time left belongs to this man himself alone. And if he wants, he will get everyone's attention immediately. I'm not putting myself in this league, but I make mistakes sometimes to be, let's say, for 1 hour or sometimes even 2 hours after the concert or even after rehearsal.
Too accessible.
Accessible, not, yes, it is the word, but also I always have a fear that if I do something, what will be seen as a rude or arrogant. So that prevents me from just escaping, you know. But Karajan, they were still applauding. I remember this very well because I was a winner of his competition. The public was still applauding, standing ovation. He was already in his car to, I believe it was Kempinski Hotel in Berlin.
Yeah.
Because I was allowed to come to one of these concerts after my own participation in his competition. I was a winner of this competition. He spent 1 hour with me talking about Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. And by the way, about Mravinsky, it was Karajan, Herbert von Karajan, who told me about his respect for Mravinsky. And I never talked to Mravinsky in my life, but I talked to his wife, widow, quite a few times. And I know more or less what he was thinking about this and that, but Herbert von Karajan had a huge respect for Mravinsky and his orchestra, obviously.
But you think you should have followed Mravinsky more and made yourself less available?
Again, available is only part answer. I think I simply have to be conscious of the fact that if I want to make in the next 5 years certain things better than I made 10 years or 15 years ago, I will have to be able to focus and concentrate even more than I did before. And it's more difficult because...
So you make this the last interview, yeah?
Well, it's one of the longest interviews in the last 10 years so far. But I don't fly to America 8-9 times a year. Mm-hmm. I don't fly 5 times a year to Japan.